So it's my great pleasure to welcome, for the first time, Michael Stusser to Many Rivers Books and Tea, along with Virginia Matthews, who has graced the store here many times as a speaker and in other capacities as well. Michael is the Osmosis Landscape Gardener. Ginny Matthews is a Zen Lay nun in the Sasaki Roshi lineage. They are going to be talking about the manifestation of ox-herding pictures that has been created in the Osmosis Garden, and what the meaning of those images is, and how it's been manifested in that space. And we are so delighted to have them both here. Welcome to Many Rivers. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for coming out tonight and to hear the story. So we're going to, Ginny and I have been working together on kind of manifesting the whole spiritual reality of the experience of how people can understand the story in the garden at Osmosis. And I'm going to tell you just a little bit about what led up to the creation of the garden, and then Ginny's going to tell you about her experience of the story. And then we're going to go through the ox-herding pictures with you as a representative in the garden and kind of take you through. Mm-hmm. So I was called to go over to Japan in the early 80s based on my interest in Zen Buddhism and also landscape gardening. And what created this interest was a whole 10 years of intensive work in organic gardening and farming. I was influenced as a college student by Alan Chadwick, who started the gardens at UC Santa Cruz and went on to be a horticulturalist who had a tremendous impact on the whole organic farming movement. And I was very involved in that whole formula, healthy soil, healthy plants, healthy people, and ended up coming up here and living in Occidental and starting the gardens at what was the Farallons Institute, which now is Occidental Arts and Ecology Center. And after more than a decade of teaching about organic gardening based on what I learned from Alan, I had an opportunity to go over and see firsthand the ancient gardening practices in China as part of a appropriate technology tour. And while I was there, I was able to stop off in Japan on the way back and walked into a Japanese garden and was totally stunned by the profound beauty of the Japanese garden and how deeply it spoke to me as a meditation practitioner and student of Buddhism. I went in December to a garden, and I felt like I was having communion with the garden artist who had created this garden 800 years ago. Mostly stone, most of the foliage had dropped, and it just opened my heart and my mind and my spirit to a whole different way of understanding what a garden could be. And ironically, I was invited to become a landscape apprentice by a Japanese gardener at that time through a series of circumstances that could be a whole other story I won't go into right now. But in any case, I was deeply moved and felt that I wanted to shift from this focus down into the soil and soil building and food production to recognizing gardening, landscape gardening, as a way to be a spiritual food. So shifting from kind of looking down to the landscape to the horizon, and I went to Japan and became a landscape gardening apprentice in Kyoto. And while I was there, I met this amazing guy from England named Robert Ketchell, and he went on to become quite a celebrated expert in Japanese gardening, with a special focus on the esoteric meaning of the rock arrangements. So not only did he work 12 hours a day as an apprentice in this medieval indentureship system that we were in, because it's very rigorous to be an apprentice in Japan, as I'm sure you've heard. But then he would go to the library at night to translate these esoteric texts. And Robert and I were both totally fascinated by the Japanese garden, and we made a vow that someday we would build a garden together. So fast forward about 15 years later, we totally lost track of each other. Robert had gone back to England and created a whole landscape company and became a lecturer and an author about Japanese gardens, and took people, and still does, takes people to Kyoto every spring and fall to tour the gardens. And if you want to get the most amazing tour of Japanese gardens, I recommend going with Robert. In any case, we lost track of each other for a decade, and through an irony, we got reconnected. And I told him I was about to build this garden and asked him if he was interested in participating. He sent back a very enthusiastic yes. And so I sent him some pictures and a map, and he sent back this incredible design of the garden. And it started this whole correspondence, and we decided we would build this garden together. So he sent me he decided to dedicate the garden to the story of the ox and the ox herder, which I wasn't familiar with this story, and build the garden based on the 10 stages of the ox and the ox herder. And he sent me drawings, sketches of the shapes of the rocks that he wanted me to find to build this garden. So I spent 2 years going to the rock yard around here, hunting for the right shaped rocks so that they could be used to build the garden. And then he came over 4 summers in a row, and we gradually built the garden. And then the big work was done by Steve Stuckey, who was a landscaper from Marin County, who's also a Zen priest and is now the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center. So that's probably enough of all of that stuff. So then, irony of ironies, Ginny shows up to help us to lead meditation in the garden. And it was only after a year of her being in the garden that I discovered that she's a lifelong student of the story of the ox and the ox herder. That's the koan that's given to her by her Zen teacher. So,
Well, actually, not the koan, but it was a formative story in my search for my spiritual practice. But we've been doing the garden sitting together before I realized that it was based on the pictures. So I encountered the ox and the ox herder as many of spiritual seekers in the early 1970s through a book called Zen Flesh, Zen Bones. There weren't too many Zen books out there. And in that book is these ox and the ox herder pictures, which are put forth as signposts on your path, your spiritual path in the Zen Buddhist tradition. And I just was immediately drawn to this parable and knew it had a lot of richness for me, and it certainly became part of my touching in my now 40-year journey of Zen practice with Sasaki Roshi. And I've been so delighted to sit every Thursday morning in this garden, this meditation garden, and come to know just what you said, the inspiration that this garden can bring. So the other piece of this is, it just seemed kind of selfish just to have this. I'm sitting there pretty much by myself from 8 to 9. It's an open invitation, anybody can come. But we also wanted to awake people to this story, and especially the people who come to Osmosis Spa. So, since most people come to Osmosis Spa are not on a Zen Buddhist spiritual journey, does this story have relevance to just people who come to this place? So this is, I think, my third year of leading garden tours to spa guests. We do it in 1 month period. And I have to say it's been really a wonderful journey to try to bring this 12th century story. I mean, who even knows? I mean, oxes and ox herders are not quite familiar to us in any case. And it's based on a Tang Dynasty spiritual practice of the 9th century or 8th century. And I'm saying, how can we make this relevant now in the 21st century? And so I've been working with that and trying to bring the parable up to comparison to everyday and modern life. And so when I lead people around this garden, that's how I tell the parable. I try to say, well, this is how it is in the Buddhist tradition, but you probably know this feeling when you do this. And we'll be talking about those stages. So I have an interesting experience in that, and we often do a little meditation on the meditation platform. And I just find that every year the story speaks clearer. Maybe it's me, or maybe it's the garden, but people really respond. Quite intrigues them, and they can say, "Oh yeah, that's true. That's true in my life," and I can understand that. So it's been a great gift. And the reason we're here tonight is because the 10th year anniversary. Michael and staff and all updated an original garden book to include both my kind of interpretation for the 21st century. It's called Ox Herding in the 21st Century, as well as more information about the plants, because a lot of the guests ask about that. And it's a wonderful guidebook, a really beautiful picture.
Yeah.
It's available. And it is really a gift. I mean, that's what I keep telling Michael. This is such a gift. It's the only garden I know, right? Based on the Ox and Ox Herder. As far as I understand, this is an original creation. And it's here in Occidental California. So we'd love to share it with you by pictures, but hopefully you will come and see it in person.
So when I went to that first garden in Kyoto, it was such an amazing moment in my life, because I had been studying meditation, and it's hard, as you all know, to start a meditation practice. You don't want that.
Can you do it?
So I sat in, when I sat in that garden in Kyoto, I felt like I had reinforcements, I had help from some friends. And it was just kind of startling to realize how difficult it is to get a hold of that flavor that we don't have in our culture. We don't have a reference point in how we build things, how we make things. It alludes to this kind of experience. And I just felt so supported in a way that I hadn't in the years of struggling to establish practice here. And I just felt it was a very compelling moment for me to think, how could we bring something like this here to help support practice, to help people have an environment, a suggestion that could help encourage a way of accessing that kind of wisdom, kind of understanding. So here's the pictures of the Oxfording story. That's Robert and I when he came over the first time to start working on the garden we met. And the first place we went was the San Francisco garden.
That's the tea garden.
Yeah. So I'm going to apologize in advance. Some of these pictures are from really early on when the garden was first new, and some of them are from when the garden is really mature. And at least one of them is out of my family photo album, because I couldn't find one from either one of those two categories. So that's the beginning of the story right there.
That's a great
view.
So,
which one are you, Ginny?
So you don't have a picture of the gate.
No.
Okay, so to enter the garden, you come through a gate, and on above the gate is the character for a good feeling, and the idea of entering that gate, you slide the door. There's and you walk in, and my sense and my belief of Japanese gardens is the idea is that you enter another consciousness. You leave behind your everyday consciousness. You're going to this new place. And so you walk in, and this is the picture number one, which is simply the ox herder. In the pictures, these pictures of 10 pictures were there are many different variations, and you'll see there are books back there with all kinds of different variations, but it's usually the ox herder either frantically running around looking for his ox, or like the one in Stephanie Wada's book, where he's just kind of casually kind of hitting the grass with his whip, you know, like, oh, gee, where's my ox? So from frantic looking around, or gee, where's my ox, the idea is something is missing. And that in the first step of a spiritual journey is something isn't right. I've lost touch. I've lost something. What is it that I've lost? And when I talk to people who come to the garden, it's many things even drive you to go to the spa or to go out for a hike is this feeling of unease, of dis-ease, and some sense of peace of mind, some sense of equanimity is lost, at least for this time. So that's the option. And picture number two is finding the traces of the ox. And here it's beautifully done in pebbles, or larger rocks in pebbles.
Beginning of being led right towards.
It's beginning to get a glimpse of what might help you with that sense of disease or lostness. In Buddhist terms, it might be hearing or reading a sutra and something waking up in you. Oh. What we like to say is that you actually, in modern life, in the midst of your franticness, in the midst of a lot of difficulty, in the midst of stress, a beautiful sunset just captures you and takes you out. And for a moment, you've forgotten that. And
that's the third one in the sequence, right. Glimpsing the ox. So this is like the first time.
Yeah.
That is actually seen. And in the foreground is a smaller stone that represents the ox herder. And so the
you can't see it right here, but right. It's right here.
So the larger rock is the body, and then the one pointing up is the head. According to Robert, the stone layer. Could apply to the imagination.
And in the pictures, the ox is usually found kind of in, you see it in the distance. It's sometimes you just see the tail, sometimes you just see the horns. It's kind of buried in a bush. So it's in the distance. And so here, when you're standing here and you're about to go on the curved path, you glimpse it. So you don't have a picture of the car. There's a wonderful old Model T Ford right here at the beginning of the path that is decomposing. Mm. And it's a great example of, is it wabi-sabi? Yeah.
Yeah.
Where in the midst of beauty, it can be this jarring reminder of disintegration or imperfection. Because here in this beautiful garden, there's this rusty old car. But what does it stand for?
Well, I mean, we left it there because the place before we started was literally a junkyard. And we wanted to leave one piece there to, as a reminder of what had been before.
Isn't it also supporting the limb from a very large tree in the back of the truck?
Yeah, it's kind of growing over it.
Yeah.
It's leaning on it, so yeah.
I thought it was deliberate.
Instead of those nice little bamboo props, it was a Model T Ford. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you've just circled around and you're coming up to the path that's going to lead into the main garden. You haven't reached the main meditation garden yet. And this is called catching the ox. And so here's our ox herder. Here's our ox. And I love the way the planting is made to also form the body of the ox in this case, which is much bigger now. This must be an early picture. The bush is way over that. Catching the ox. In the Buddhist or the Zen journey, this is where you're really making a commitment to your spiritual practice. You've either found, well, usually it's finding a teacher who's going to lead you on this path or guide you on this path. And you're making this commitment to step into spiritual practice. in everyday life, we talk about how that glimpse of the sunset helped you realize that something was missing in your life, or some quality that maybe you had remembered was missing. And glimpsing the ox, we often liken to a deeper experience, like going on a hiking trip for a week. And being that quiet and that away from the dis-ease of your life, or of your of modern life. And here, there becomes a knowledge that you're going to have to make a commitment. You have to make a commitment to find a way to live in the world on your terms and your truth. And that can be different for everybody. It doesn't have to be a spiritual practice. For some people, it's they're tai chi, you know, doing yoga, or making sure they walk every morning so they really hear the birds before they go off and commute to the city. So everyone's commitment is different, but the commitment is the important thing.
So I put in a couple of pictures of, this is my favorite rock arrangement of the set. Uh-huh. I like them all, but this one has a special funny one. This is Taming the Ox. So this is kind of the most dynamic relationship in setting up this tension between the unruly mind and the struggle of ego that's so hard to let go. Where the rubber meets the road, right? And I particularly love this photo. We had some photographer from the New York Times come.
Now,
feeling the mood of the, just what is represented on by the garden and the spa in this picture as well.
This is the meditation platform, right? Right here?
It's where, yeah.
So, is there a picture of the platform?
Yeah.
Ah, okay. So when you and there's not a picture of the moon gate.
Yeah,
Up later.
It's coming up.
Okay.
Number 8, right? The circle, right?
But okay, so we just passed Catching the Ox. We stepped through this beautiful round moon gate onto the meditation platform, and to me that's the heart of, you've made the commitment, and now. Here, at least for many people, the tool is meditation. The tool is the meditation. So it's the heart of this garden, is the meditation platform. And so here, when we start going around, you do come to Taming the Ox, and it seems that the meditation is, for many people, a wonderful tool to go through resistances, get through fears, any difficulties that's going to stop your progress. And when I talk with people, we kind of say, well, you've made that commitment. You know what's going to bring better, what's going to bring more ease in your life, more health in your life, more pleasure in your life. But can you keep that commitment? Can you get up at 6 in the morning for that 7 o'clock yoga class before you go to work? Can you really take the time on Sunday to go hiking instead of always drinking your coffee and reading the papers? So we talk about what can help you harness the taming of the ox. That's what the taming of the ox is.
And a couple other things I'd just like to point out that are shown here is that little fence, that motif is a classic Chinese motif. It's double happiness is what it signifies, and it goes all the way around on the platform there. And then the red gravel is symbolizes water. It's called Kari Sansui, Japanese landscape gardening. And then just in terms of the rock setting, it's unorthodox to have the stone that's tipping back represents the ox herder holding the reins and having a really hard time with this huge animal, and the reddish rock pointing up at the head. And body, according to Robert. And the one, the rock that's tipping, that's almost completely out of the ground, normally in the tradition of landscape gardening, according to Hoyle, you would always bury a good third at least of the rock But he wanted to show the tenuousness
mm-hmm.
of the oxer at this stage of the game and how easy it is to fall off and lose your equilibrium and not be able to sustain that effortless effort, thinking, non-thinking, on these incredibly difficult moments.
Mm-hmm. Wow, this is an earlier picture. Yes, our little bush has grown up quite a bit, so it's totally covering. This is part of it, right?
Yeah. So this is one, is called Riding the Ox, and the stone in the middle is representative of the ox herder on the back of the ox. And now, at this stage of the game, the ox herder is metaphorically larger than the ox, so the body and the headstones of the ox are smaller, and the ox herder is growing larger. And of all the woodblock prints in this series, this is the one that would be most familiar to you. It shows the ox herder facing backwards, playing his flute as he's riding the ox. So now there's this totally complete mastery of mm-hmm. the animal, so much so that the ox is going to go do exactly what the ox herder wants it to do without him having to exert any kind of effort whatsoever.
And there's also a sense of play in the poems. There are poems and commentaries on the poems that accompany these. They talk about the playful spirit of the flute player, and he's playing children's songs. So there's a kind of recapturing of that original lightheartedness and playful spirit that once some mastery of the mind happens. There's a freedom for play. So this is Ox Forgotten, Man Remains. And in the pictures, he's usually in a little hut, kind of gazing out on a gorgeous Chinese landscape, with the symbols of his trade, which is the whip and the rope, laid by his on the floor. He doesn't need them anymore. He doesn't even need the ox. They're merged. Ox and man are one. And he's at peace. So there's a sense of peaceful equanimity as he gazes out on the landscape, and a non-duality, and no sense of separating, no sense of struggle, even playfulness, but just unity, a really unity between mind and heart. So, this is the Moon Gate. And usually, as we're walking around, there's the picture we just saw, we're standing at this side of the garden looking back at the Moon Gate. And that was my contribution to the. I said, "Oh, a perfect Enso." Enso is the circle that is picture number 8. Picture number 8 is they're different. Ox and man transcended, I think.
Also emptiness.
I don't know if they ever use that term. Transcending the ox is usually what's transcendence, or transcending the ox is usually what it says. And originally, this pond is shaped in the kanji for the letter, for the word shin. Shin means heart, mind, no separation. So that was part of, I think Robert was using that sense of the field of heart mind as the transcendence of the ox. But I really like the Enso. I was always putting out the Moon Gate.
Well, the Enso is that classic thing of the moon reflected in water.
Yeah.
And so Robert's idea was that the pond represented the reflection of the moon. And he would talk about that being the ultimate form of compassion, in terms of how we can reflect back to others, being mm-hmm. devoid of preferences and likes and dislikes, and that's the gift of that reflective quality. Clean your clock.
Well, in Zen practice, there is this point, whether it's a huge experience of what we call the universe or God or Dharmakaya, whatever terms, the absolute, whatever terms you use, whether it's a complete and deep experience, which may be called enlightenment, or in some sects, they use Kensho, the smaller realizations that may not be as complete. But there is that moment of realization of all is oneness, and there is no, the famous Heart Sutra, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. And it is in this picture that it becomes no form. And it's interesting when I talking about those terms with people who are not necessarily on a spiritual practice, I always see that, yes, I've had that experience, not everyone, but that experience of the wonder, the mystery. So this is picture number 9, returning to the source. And there are actually some of the Oxfordian pictures stop at picture number 8, not too many. But I always like to tell the story of my teacher who said, it's fine to visit the absolute, but we're human, you can't stay there, you gotta eat, you gotta go to the bathroom, you don't stay in that state of complete melting into the universe. So, but when you return from that experience, the world is a little different. You recognize your place in all of nature, of being part of it. And that's usually, and so it's usually represented by just a beautiful picture of nature, returning to the source. And here we can't see it all, but this lovely mound with a waterfall and a beautiful bridge, a really favorite place to contemplate returning to the source. This is my favorite. In the pictures of the Oxherder, he usually starts as a young boy and ends up an old man. This is our Oxherder, a little gnarled for the journey, a little wrinkled. And often he's of kind of Hotei figure, the happy Buddha figure with the big belly and carrying his possessions. And it's my favorite title is Returning to the Marketplace with Bliss Bestowing Hands. So not only do you emerge from that experience of the absolute, not only do you recognize your true nature and your true place in the world, but you need to give that gift back to your community. In this case, it's the village. And here, this is represented, it's a little hard to see, but it really looks like this rock is bowing to the elder. And it's hard to see, but the meditation platform is right there. So we've made a complete circle, and we've ended up back at the village. And that what I love to tell people is, oh my gosh, and here we are, back on the meditation platform. Oh, the journey's not really over. I got to go through this again, over and over again, the circle. And I'm not sure if Robert designed it that way, but I thought it was brilliant. I thought that those first stages of realizing you've lost something, finding the traces, catching a glimpse, and making the commitment are first stages, but once you stepped onto that platform, it's a journey that keeps going in a circle. You have to go back and tame that mind. You have to back and realize and find your playfulness and find the equanimity and have the experience of the oneness and keep bringing your gifts back. So I think it's just an exquisite metaphor that I get to contemplate every week. Are there more pictures?
A couple more. I just wanted to say about this mm-hmm. one. Robert spent such a long time setting these two stones, and he kind of elaborated the story a little bit, saying, so this is the ox that are returning from this long journey in the wilderness. He's approaching the marketplace, and the other stone is someone from inside the marketplace looking out, recognizing his wisdom, running out, bowing down, asking to be his disciple. So mm-hmm. it's kind of a kinetic moment there in the, mm-hmm. That he was trying to capture the way he set these two stones.
Do you have a picture of the guardian stone?
No, I just stuck to the story on this one, but I have a couple more pictures that shows probably a lot of you. How many of you have actually been out there?
This is so. We also have. Is this the best picture of Turtle Island?
Yeah, that's as much as there is.
Right. This represents Turtle Island. There's actually a stone that sticks out that looks like his head, and this is like the paw. And that's because of, many of these gardens, there is some symbol of longevity and wisdom.
Yeah, the ancient Chinese believe that turtles live for 10,000 years. And then the pine tree planted on the back of the turtle is the crane, riding on the back turtle's back. And those two wedded together is a symbol of longevity, has been for a long time. So.
What about the juniper tree out on the...
The other one? It's on the other side.
The one that you see when you look straight across.
The question mark tree.
The question mark tree. Oh, just that? It's
yeah.
not longevity either?
No, it's just future.
Beautiful. And did there used to be a statue of a crane there?
No, but the garden was designed so that Robert wanted to put a one in on it. And have it set up so that when you came through the gate and kneeled down to wash your hands and scoop by a little basin, there would be a little hole cut in the hedge there. Mm-hmm. And we would have just a little sneak peek of the Buddha standing on that rock.
Mm.
So we were going to get a sculpture for that rock, and then we found a great big beautiful bronze Buddha. It was too big for the rocks, so we had it somewhere else for a while. It didn't really fit in. The garden, just the natural forms of the garden, to have a sculpture, and it was creating kind of a funny tension for us. And we just said, now we won't have a sculpture in there.
Well, often, early in the morning, there is a heron. At least there used to be when there was more fish. The heron I would look up sometimes. That's a nice thing about my particular practice is open-eyed meditation. So you get a little glimpse of what's going on, especially when the otter, the mother otter and the three babies showed up to raid the pond of fish. We finally figured out what was going on, and I got to see them. The Salmon Creek runs right along this garden, very close. So it's a wonderful juxtaposition of the wild and the cultivated. I always enjoy that too as I come into the garden to experience the wildness of the creek and then the cultivated garden.
It's just been an amazing journey. It continues to be. As the garden matures and more people sit and meditate in the garden, it's just containing more and more of those kind of a vibrational force field. I think you sound like you're aging, but and then there's some real intrinsic power in this story, and mm-hmm. it's why it's been used for so long to develop practice, and it is an amazing for Jenny and for me as well to have the opportunity to continue to explore the story. And every time we share it with other people going through the garden, it just presents yet another opportunity to see all the different nuances and the character that it has.
And I just want to share that, so last week, last Thursday night, we had someone talk about Shintoism, and the kami and the spirits. And I've always felt the spirits in the garden, but I thought I'd be a little more alert to it after that Shinto. And they're there. They're definitely there. And I really appreciate the three guardian rocks that you didn't show that are kind of a Shinto feature, as kind of designated to be the spirits that overlook the garden. And I appreciate having them there. And just the garden has just its own voice, and I think it's just wonderful that Michael has made it available to the public. So I really, you know, encourage you to come on Thursday mornings or to do a spa treatment, because the other thing that it is a helpful, and it is a chance to step out the whole experience of the spa and the whole experience of the gardens and everything that Michael has brought there is to give you that glimpse of how to be more at ease, how to recognize your place once you step out of the churning of your mind and the churning of your everyday life. It is truly a place of peace. So I think it's a great gift to our community.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is the story of the ox and the ox herder?
I just told you.
No, not exactly.
They're the 10 pictures.
All right.
The 10 pictures that are this ox. The parable is this: the ox herder has lost his ox. He sees the traces. He finds a glimpse of it. He catches it, tames it, rides it home. Doesn't need the ox anymore. Everything disappears. He returns to his basic true nature, and then he gives that gift back to the community.
Thank you.
In a nutshell.
That was good. Weren't the last two in that sequence much more modern developments than the original?
Did you have something to say about that?
Yeah, Taoist usage of the Oxford picture, which some scholars believe predates Buddhist usage, there are only eight, and it ends with emptiness. But in all Buddhist contexts, going way, way back, they have the 10. And there's debate about whether Buddhists added the last two.
Right.
Or whether there were even pre-Buddhist different versions of it.
Oh. You know,
when I was in Korea, the ox herding pictures were a common theme at Korean temples, usually painted on the outside of the temple, not on the inside, because the inside of the temple was used for a lot of ceremonies and things like that. But they would have the 10 ox herding pictures. You could walk around the temple, like the ceremony hall, for example, and the 10 ox herding pictures would be there. Very, very widespread in Korea. And it was the 10. But there are historical examples, carvings, for example, that only had the 8. Like I say, there's differences of opinion about which groups had just the 8 and which groups.
I know, it's pretty unclear when you go into it.
Yeah. But all the versions for many centuries now have the 10.
Okay. Do you think it might be that when the Buddhists took it from the Taoists, the last two is bringing in the whole of Bodhisattva?
Yes. That's the hypothesis, because in Taoist configuration that is not a strong motivator, you know. To so, like the story of Lao Tzu, which may have been a basis for the oxygen pictures, is that when society becomes corrupt, he leaves. And the story about Lao Tzu is that he met a guardian at the mountain pass, you know, like, and he said, "I'm out of here."
And, too corrupt for me.
And the guardian said, "Well, before you leave, I want you to leave a record of your teaching." And Lao Tzu wrote the Tao Te Ching, you know, like, which is not long. You know, and then he disappeared into the mountain, never to be seen again. You know, like, that story is not about returning to, you know, it's about absorption in great nature. And so there, I don't see one as better than the other, but there is a difference in the way the story is told. You know, like, if Lao Tzu, the figure of Lao Tzu is one who becomes one with great nature, and that's the end.
Right.
Know, that's the end of the story. Although it's interesting because in section 81 of the Tao Te Ching, is the closing section is a portrait of the perfect village. You know, like, the perfect village is one where the villagers have no need to go to the next village, even though they know it's over there. You know, like, and they lead quiet, simple lives. I think that's section 81. It's one of the last sections. You know, like, so you could construe that as a kind of return.
But the sense of giving your gifts back to the community and to, as the vow, the Bodhisattva vow to save all sentient beings, is really very intrinsic to Mahayana Buddhism.
Yes.
Which is where Zen comes from. The evolution of Zen is from Indian Buddhism through Chinese Buddhism called Chan to the Japanese and Korean, Vietnamese. Strands.
And of course, now we have this frontier in the West.
And, the wild frontier.
The wild frontier. It's really, you know, interesting to have this project. I've been almost 30 years working on the Osmosis project now. And, it's very much been about creating a meditative experience in a meditative environment and building a cultural bridge to some of the wisdom and sensibilities that I discovered when I was living in Japan. And even though this garden obviously has very deep philosophical Buddhist underpinnings, you know, we've got a lot of people, most of the people coming don't have any familiarity with anything we're talking about right now. Mm-hmm. So we wanted to create the garden in such a way that it would be an access point to what we're talking about without having to use any of this terminology or put out any story. So it's only been recently that we've taken the time to really go back and actually chronicle in detail all the intention behind it that went into it, and that's what's in the book. And there's a lot of detail. There's Robert's whole thinking behind each of the 10 stations of the ox and the ox herder in the front, and then in the back is Jenny's more contemporary interpretation. So now we do have both. When people want it, they can have the more access.
And I must say that whatever is by osmosis, this access to meditation is happening. I mean, I've been doing this for 3 years, and it's a different, I find the people in a different space than when I started. And I just did, someone asked me to come and just do lead a meditation group for 8 people who had come for a day of the spa. So, you know, I was going to do just my 5 minutes, because I asked if anyone had meditated before, and none of them, one person had, 1 out of 8. So I do my little instruction, and I ring the bell, and we start the sit for 5 minutes, and I realize they are completely grounded and present. They are so into their meditation. So after 5 minutes, it was like, I shouldn't interrupt this. They're really into it. But I know they had other things they had to do. So I think we went to 7 or 8 minutes, and I rang the bell, and they still didn't stop. And I said, you know, I think you have other things to go. And they just looked at me. And I just felt that they had truly gotten to that. The garden had worked its magic. The spa had worked its magic. And they had just dropped into it, into a deep meditative state. And I see this, you know, some of you may have been at my talk with Ann Scott where we shared that we do meditation for homeless women at the living room. And I was just there this morning. I love it. I go from 8 to 9, I'm at the meditation garden, and then from 10 to 11, I'm at the homeless shelter, the day homeless shelter. And I'm still amazed, we've been doing this almost 3 years, at the quality of ability for these women to drop into deep meditation. And one woman who had never meditated before, she said, "Was I asleep?" And said, no. Never felt such rest. I've never felt such peace. And she, her friend, who had been in a very terrible situation only hours before, and she turned to her friend, she said, "And I even forgot your troubles." You know, I was able to drop it, you know, and she was just so amazed. So whether it's our culture, like you said, this trying to make this bridge from these ancient tools for deep meditation and quiet, I think it's happening. And thank you for your part around you.
So how does one avail oneself of this opportunity to?
Well, there's a lot of ways. I mean, Jenny, the meditation period is 8 to 9.
And it's informal. You don't have to sit the whole time. You can walk in the garden.
So you're welcome, and there's no charge. And then, of course, this is also an extension of our day retreat spa. So you can go and experience the only cedar enzyme bath outside of Japan, which is a unique form of heat therapy that we've pioneered. We've been offering for 27 years now, which has high therapeutic value. Really beneficial for your circulation and your metabolism. It's a fantastic prelude to a massage, so you can have that service, or you can get a massage or a facial. We have quite a range of services, and for anyone who's interested who doesn't already know it, we've got a brand new super spiffy brochure. I'm happy to share that with anybody would like that.
And there's also a wonderful event for the community.
And we're evolving more and more events. We're really interested in health, wellness, and vitality. We're developing all kinds of vitality quests, the name of the programs we're working on developing. So we're working with developing a breath awareness massage as a way to help people get much more connected with their breathing and present moment awareness in the process of receiving a massage. excuse me. We're having more meditation talks and classes in the garden that include various types of spa experience to go with them as a way for people to experience the garden and teaching.
And concerts, too.
And then we have a summer concert series, which we're organizing. We have 4 concerts this year. They'll be posted on our website pretty soon, including we have Rumi's Caravan last year. We'll have it again this year. That's a good one. Super good one.
And sometimes Elliot plays shakuhachi there, which
that's
is
right.
A perfect blend of the meditation flute and the meditation garden.
And then Jenny does tours at certain times of the year.
September.
And we did a, together we did an Oxfording workshop last September, which we're going to put another one of those on the calendar.
Can the public go visit the garden? Just if we wanted to go to Freestone, could we?
You know, it's
or do you close it? For
it's
your
primarily own? For our guests, but we do. If it's really busy and we have a lot of guests, then it may not be accessible. But if it's, you know, a Tuesday and there's only two cars in the parking lot, you drive up, you can go out and walk in the park.
Any other questions?
I think you said this already, but would you revisit the moment when you realized that the teaching story that had guided your path was represented in this garden? How that came about?
Well, I think it was just that Michael finally mentioned it to me. And, you know, I just saw a beautiful garden with lots of rocks. And then at one point, I think we were at Laura's place, he said, would you like me to show you? And I said, yes, I would very much. So he took me around and showed me which rocks represented. And I knew, you know, I knew the story very well. So
it was funny because years before I built the garden, I remember seeing a flyer in Sebastopol about this woman who was leading a workshop on the story of the Ox.
Right, Laura and I were going to lead a workshop.
And then when I discovered that it was you in that moment, it's like we both kind of flipped.
So you had already been leading meditation on Thursday morning?
For close to a year.
Yeah.
Before we figured it out.
Yeah.
It's funny, the irony.
Because I think, was it Steve who started it? And then, since he wasn't local, I said I'd be happy to just kind of keep it going. And
we actually had Daigaku, who was a monk from Japan, started the sitting there.
I just bring blankets, I tell people, because it's a little... A little chilly.
Did you bring your own meditation cushion? And
no, they have, if you saw, there were four, and there's usually not that many people, so you're okay. And there's also benches. There are people who don't want to sit on cushions, you can sit on benches.
But if you do have a cushion that you like, you don't mind bringing it, it's actually a good idea, because the cushions we have are not so great, and it's difficult for us to keep them dry.
And even keep them, you know, there's one missing now.
Oh dear.
The otters.
There's only building a nest back there.
I have a question about the rocks themselves. I mean, I was very struck by the beauty. How some of them looked as if I could have found them tumbled down into a creek here in Sonoma County, serpentine rock or something like that. And I'm wondering, you said that you were going around looking.
Right.
Were you only trying to fit your choice to the vision that Robert had, or was there another way that you were there other criteria that you brought to the selection process?
Well, mostly I was really seeking to get the rocks to match the shape, but I also was looking for rocks that had a lot of appeal. And I was also wanting to get granite. I got all the rocks from Walter Johnson's Rock Yard, which is on Santa Rosa Avenue. And it's a landscapers come from all over the state to get rocks. So they've been bringing in rocks for, I don't know, since the 40s. For the rock house, it's kind of a mecca place there. And I would just go there when a new loads came. After I got familiar with their inventory, I'd go there when a truck would come.
Got it.
Yeah. I remember a couple times I saw a rock that I knew was the right rock, and I was on the truck. Because early on, I found some rocks that I really wanted, and I came back, and they said, sorry, you can't have somebody else came.
It must have been quite a challenge to get those very large rocks into there.
Yeah, well, Robert was originally going to do it the way they do it in Japan, which is you set up a big tripod with three large poles, and you get a chain and a hoist, and you pull it up, and you swing it, and then you release it, and it drops, and then you move it over, and...
Whoa.
But he soon really got it. Involved with the wonders of hydraulics.
the evolution.
The creation of the garden was really one of the greatest joys of my life, because we had this incredible team. We had Don Miguel, who was a local rancher, fourth generation, grew up on a 640-acre ranch, just like literally blocks from Osmosis. Mm. And when he was a child, there were still a couple of natives of the area living on that property, Indians. And he's just a total salt of the earth rancher, which was livestock, and he loves koi and ponds, and he was extremely deft with his backhoe. And so, and then Steve, the Zen priest from Zen Center, and then Robert, this incredibly studied Englishman, and the three of them, and myself, every morning we meet and kind of scope out the work for the day. And, it was just an absolutely fantastic collaboration, and it was a tremendous joy and pleasure. We never had any conflict or disagreements. It was just a very inspired, all the way through, inspiration.
And the pictures of the before and after are pretty amazing.
Yeah. And it's just a field.
Yeah,
just a
field. With junk, huh?
Can we see the pictures again? Could you just run through them?
Could you do that quickly?
Sure.
Now that we know the story and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Can you do meditation even in the training?
Oh, yeah. If it's blowing really hard, the meditation platform has a roof, so it is protected unless the wind is really hard. Are those your daughters?
Yeah.
The traces. Glimpsing the ox.
Glimpsing the oxen.
Catching the ox.
Catching the oxen.
Taming the ox. That's taming the ox. And riding the ox home. Ox forgotten, man remains. Transcending. Circle, returning to the source, and returning to the marketplace with bliss bestowing hands.
Yeah, it's funny all these different interpretations that you used to say. When Robert originally did his translation, he used this word, returning to the marketplace empty handed.
Right.
And then when Ginny first started telling about her translation, it was returning to the marketplace with gift bestowing hands.
I thought it was bliss bestowing hands.
And then at some point it became bliss. I like that even better.
Well, that's the one that I like the best.
Yeah.
I mean, they have so the interpretation, like this was just entering the marketplace. You know, so each one. This is one of my favorite. I don't know if you have Stephanie Wada's. I like it because it does it Japanese style from back to front.
Mm.
Oh, and this one is really interesting. Entering the city with hands hanging down. So obviously there's a wide interpretation. The wide interpretation of the Chinese. So.
I like the bliss bestowing hands.
I do too. That's my favorite one. So that's the last one.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Thank you on behalf of Many Rivers. So I'll just
turn off the tape.
I'll just turn off the tape.